Slick roads caused dozens of crashes in western Montana, including at least one fatality. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Edward O'Brien tells us about the opening day in the trial of a newlywed accused of murdering her husband in Glacier Park. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a research hydrologist about a new study showing less wind means less snow in the Pacific Northwest. The Montana Highway Patrol says icy roads contributed to a fatal head-on crash on Highway 212 near Charlotte today, one of dozens of crashes on our icy, snow-packed roads. The patrol says a car slid into the path of an oncoming pickup truck at about 11 this morning. Kerr AM reports the woman driving the car died at the scene. Her name, age, and hometown are being withheld while family members are notified. The two people in the pickup truck were treated at the hospital and released. Patrol Captain Jim Kitchen says there have been over 30 crashes just in the Missoula area alone, mainly because people are driving too fast for the conditions.
This happens every year when we get snow on the roads. People don't slow down. The roadways are slick, got a little bit of wind on top of it here, and they're iced up pretty good. And I think, you know, with the cold weather that we had the last couple of days, everybody was driving fine, and then we put a little bit of snow on top of frozen roads, and we have a mess.
Missoula County Sheriff's spokeswoman Paige Pavilone says the high number of wrecks are straining emergency resources trying to respond.
And these crashes are ranging from people being ejected to slide off, so we're getting the whole gamut. So we're just really, really encouraging people to, if you can, stay off the roads and avoid travel. But if you do have to travel, just go extremely, extremely slowly.
And buckle up. Conditions are expected to worsen tonight as temperatures continue to drop and more snow continues to fall, up to 5 inches in some valleys. We'll have the forecast later on in this broadcast.
And in other news from around the state, jury selection began today in the murder trial of a newlywed bride accused of pushing her husband from a cliff in Glacier National Park just days after their wedding. Jordan Graham has pleaded not guilty to charges of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and making a false statement to authorities in the death of Cody Johnson. Prosecutors say the 22-year-old Graham and 25-year-old Johnson had been married for 8 days when they argued over her doubts about the marriage. She texted a friend that she planned to confront Johnson about those doubts on the night of July 7th. Dozens of friends, acquaintances, and expert witnesses are expected to testify during the trial. None, however, saw the incident. Edward O'Brien attended today's proceedings and files this report.
U.S. District Judge Donald Malloy opened today's trial by telling attorneys and the pool of prospective jurors that he has another case scheduled for Monday in Billings. Malloy said he does not want to reschedule and made it clear he hopes to have the Jordan Graham case to the jury by this Friday. That's an ambitious goal given the expected volume of testimony this week. Federal prosecutors will attempt to convince jurors that Graham deliberately pushed Johnson to his death, then made up a story about how he was last seen driving off with friends. Graham's federal public defenders will ask jurors to believe that while Graham thought she married too young, she loved Johnson and was only trying to remove his hand from her arm when he fell. Malloy himself questioned prospective jurors today, quizzing each if they understood the difference between premeditated first-degree murder and unplanned intentional second-degree murder. The judge repeated several times that it was up to the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Graham is guilty. He also pointed out the jury cannot hold it against her if Graham chooses not to take the stand in her own defense. Federal public defender Michael Donahoe says federal prosecutors have mostly circumstantial evidence in their push to prove the killing was premeditated. Assistant U.S. Attorney Zeno Baucus wrote in his own brief that Graham had told Johnson before the wedding that she had a surprise planned for him. Baucus says that after she pushed him, she didn't call police or seek any assistance. Instead, he wrote, Graham began sending text messages to friends, planting stories about Johnson's disappearance and talking about her dance moves. A few of the prospective jurors have scientific backgrounds. Malloy quizzed them on the value of DNA evidence, to which most replied that it would depend on context, how and where it was collected. If found guilty, Graham would not face the death penalty. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Edward O'Brien.
A jury of 8 men and 6 women in the Jordan Graham trial were seated this afternoon.
Advocates for women say a Montana judge's acknowledgement that he mishandled a teacher-student rape case does not go far enough. District Judge G. Todd Boss says he deserves to be censured for saying at the rapist sentencing the 14-year-old victim appeared, quote, older than her chronological age, end quote. But representatives of two chapters of the National Organization for Women say Boss should be removed from the bench. The group said in a weekend filing with the State Judicial Standards Commission that Baugh's actions showed prejudice against the young Hispanic victim. The commission meets tomorrow in proceedings closed to the public. It has not said if it will act on complaints against Baugh. Separately, an appeal is pending before the Supreme Court on the month-long prison sentence that Baugh handed down in the case.
A twin-engine airplane carrying five passengers made a hard landing at Glacier Park International Airport near Kalispell, injuring two people on board. Airport Director Cindy Martin says the Beach Baron arrived shortly after 9 a.m. today, made a hard landing, and veered off the side of the runway. One of the passengers was seriously injured and another suffered minor injuries. Both were taken to Kalispell Regional Medical Center. Martin said officials from the Federal Aviation Administration were expected to arrive today to begin an investigation. FAA records indicate the airplane is registered to KSZT LLC in Sandpoint, Idaho.
A Montana State University fraternity has accepted permanent sanctions for violating the university's alcohol policy. The sanctions come 3 months after a woman said she believed she had been drugged and sexually assaulted at the Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity house during a party. Campus police have turned over the results of their investigation to the Gallatin County Attorney's Office. MSU Dean of Students Matt Kyrus says the sanctions include prohibiting the consumption of hard alcohol on fraternity property and requiring sexual assault prevention training for members. Beer and wine will still be allowed at fraternity parties. The fraternity has also agreed to have several members remain sober during gatherings to make sure guests get home safely. If Pi Kappa Alpha commits future violations, it could lose its university recognition.
Officials in Beaverhead County say a man helping with a Montana Wounded Warriors Program duck hunt over the weekend was injured when he was hit below the eye with birdshot. Sheriff Jay Henson says Jason Baker shot a duck Saturday afternoon near Dillon. While retrieving the duck, another hunter from the same party shot at a low-flying group of ducks and birdshot hit Baker just below the eye. Baker was treated in the emergency room at Barrett Hospital in Dillon and then taken to St. Patrick Hospital in Missoula. Hansen says Baker told his office today that he was doing well and planned to get back to work at the Wounded Warrior program soon.
The Rosebud County Sheriff's Office is asking for help in finding a Forsyth woman who was last seen on November 25th. The Sheriff's Office says 37-year-old Sally Annette Krueger was last seen leaving her house at about 5:30 p.m. Sheriff Randy Allies tells the Billings Gazette there is no reason to suspect foul play in Krueger's disappearance. A family member reported she had shown signs of depression, left without explanation, and did not take any personal belongings or identification. Krueger is described as being 5 feet 3 inches tall, 140 pounds, with reddish-brown hair and blue eyes. She was last seen wearing a hooded beige Levi jacket, dark blue jeans, and pink and black Nike shoes. Anyone with information is asked to call the Sheriff's Office at 406-346-2715.
An increase in freight traffic and hundreds of millions of dollars of improvements on BNSF railway tracks across North Dakota and Montana combined to make Amtrak travel less than reliable in recent months. The Flathead Beacon reports the eastbound Empire Builder, which travels from Chicago to Portland and Seattle, had a 0% on-time performance during October. BNSF spokesman Matthew Jones says one of the main reasons for the delays are track improvements being made in the railroad's northern route between the Midwest and the Pacific Northwest. Jones says there are also more oil trains and general freight trains running across the High Line. Jones says the track repairs were wrapping up. Amtrak spokesman Mark Magliari says railroad is expecting to be able to improve its on-time performance.
The U.S. Department of the Interior today says it has finalized the first cooperative agreement in a $1.9 billion Native American land buyback program stemming from the settlement of a nearly 17-year lawsuit over more than a century's worth of mismanaged trust royalties. The agreement reached with the Oglala Sioux Tribe of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota outlines the strategy and resources to be provided to tribal leaders for outreach and education. The 10-year buyback program is the largest part of the $3.4 billion settlement of a class action lawsuit filed by the late Eloise Cobell of Browning in 1996 and finalized last year. The department says outreach is already underway on Pine Ridge, and the department intends to make the first offers by the end of the year.
The governor of Montana will appear at a fundraiser for Maryland Attorney General Douglas Gansler, who is running in a crowded Democratic primary next year for governor. Montana Governor Steve Bullock, a Democrat, is scheduled to appear tomorrow as the special guest at a home in Bethesda. The campaign is asking for donations of at least $150. Bullock last year did what Gansler hopes to do, move from attorney general to governor. An aide told the Washington Post that Gansler and Bullock got to know each other well through the National Association of Attorneys General and the Democratic Attorneys General Association. Maryland's Democratic Governor Martin O'Malley has endorsed his Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown in the primary.
Millions of bats are dying from a poorly understood disease called white nose syndrome. The disease is heading west, and scientists fear it could devastate Montana's bat populations. That would have big consequences ecologically and also economically, since bats help farmers and ranchers by eating pest insects. But little is known about Montana's bats. Reporter Allison Mills of Science Source took to the field with researchers who are learning more about the nocturnal critters by listening closely to their ultrasonic sounds.
I know I have a pair at home.
Bryce Maxwell and Andrea Shortsleeve test the microphone on a bat detector near Painted Rocks Dam in the Bitterroot National Forest. Maxwell studies bats and is a senior zoologist with the Montana Natural Heritage Program. He drives around the state to help install and maintain bat detectors.
In towns like Hamilton that we're driving through right now, or, you know, towns across the state, bats are flying around all the time, and it kind of sounds like Star Wars once you can hear those ultrasonic, noises being made.
Maxwell's bat detectors pick up those noises made by passing bats, high-frequency sounds beyond the limit of human hearing. That's a little brown bat call, lowered in pitch so humans can hear it, and slowed down, otherwise it would sound like this. If people could hear these calls outside, they would be as loud as a plane passing overhead. This one is a silver-haired bat. The calls help bats form a picture of the space and objects around them, like sonar, helping them find dinner, which may be a pesky mosquito or crop-devouring insect. Bats' big appetite for insects makes them important little critters, ecologically and economically. Scientists are working to better understand bats and the threats they face across the country. Every year, it's estimated that wind turbines kill tens of thousands of bats. And since 2006, white nose syndrome has decimated populations in the East, killing millions and destroying as much as 70% of winter colonies.
You know, it would be akin in Montana to driving across the state and not seeing any meadowlarks or any robins. You know, they just sort of die off in a year or two and they're gone.
White nose syndrome is caused by a soil-dwelling fungus, which is spreading westward. It is found as far west as Minnesota and Oklahoma. Researchers fear it's just a matter of time before it reaches Montana. Wildlife biologist Jeannie Spahr helped set up two bat detectors on the Fort Peck Reservation. She says getting baseline data is key to making management decisions, but the statewide collaboration is just getting off the ground.
We were just determining baseline population just so we knew what we had and so we could go from there and try to plan for the future and find out what we even needed to be planning.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently proposed listing the northern long-eared bat as an endangered species because of widespread die-off. The species range reaches as far west as eastern Montana and Wyoming. Zoologist Bryce Maxwell.
Nobody wins if species become listed.
The comment period is open until January 2, 2014. For Montana Public Radio, I'm Allison Mills.
The U.S. Air Force Precision Flying Team is scheduled to appear at a Labor Day weekend air show in Kalispell next year. The Air Force announced last week that its elite Thunderbirds are back on schedule for performances across the country next year, and that includes the Mountain Madness Air Show on August 30th and 31st. Kalispell Chamber of Commerce Vice President Chris Parson tells the Flathead Beacon the Thunderbird squadron that visits Kalispell is set to include Kalispell native Captain Jason Curtis. The Thunderbirds had been scheduled to perform in Kalispell in July, but the performance was among those canceled due to federal budget cuts.
A recent article in the journal Science investigates whether decreasing winds in the Pacific Northwest and Northern Rockies are contributing to declining precipitation. The article attributes this to both natural climate variations and man-made climate change. The research was led by research hydrologist Charlie Luce with the Rocky Mountain Research Station's Aquatic Sciences Laboratory in Boise, along with colleagues from the University of Idaho and the northern region of the U.S. Forest Service. In this feature interview, Luce tells news director Sally Mock that the research grew out of a bit of a puzzle they were trying to solve.
Trends in Stream Flow, which was a paper a few years ago and published that. But the puzzle came when we looked at precipitation data, and the precipitation data for the region broadly taken from those stations with the best long-term records were flat and not showing much trend. Kind of had us scratching our heads because I would imply that it's all evaporation, but we started looking at the evaporation side and didn't really... There were anecdotes, really, that suggested it wasn't evaporation. And so it was a matter of pinning down what are the hard facts that we can do to decide whether it was or was not evaporation. That was the first piece. Once we figured that out, then we had a pretty clear picture that high elevation areas were getting less precipitation than low elevation, or seeing a trend in that the low elevation was not seeing. And then it went on to trying to understand why that was the case.
And this was really also prompted by the fact that our stream flows in the Northern Rockies are lower and getting lower all the time.
Yeah, they have been getting lower since the 1950s. If you go back as far as the 1930s, they were low then and pretty comparable to now. Some of the recent past has actually been worse than the 30s. And as far as where it goes from here, you know, that kind of a trend 1950 to now is not something that you would extrapolate into the future to say that's what's going on right now. But we, you know, in trying to understand the processes, some of them are related to low, very slow moving climate, you know, things like El Nino and Pacific Decadal Oscillation that are ocean temperature changes that can be slow. And some of them are connected to what we would expect from anthropogenic climate change. So those that are connected to anthropogenic climate change, we would expect to continue, but some of the climate cycle mediated ones, we would not expect to, but we'd expect those to change with the climate cycles.
And what your study found is that there has been a slowdown of westerly winds that blow off the ocean, and that is affecting precipitation.
The winds coming off the ocean do a couple of things. One is that they carry the moisture off the ocean and up over the mountains, and the more that is sort of processed by the mountains with the lifting of the air over the mountains cools it. As the moist air off of the ocean is cooled, the precipitation condenses out first as fog and clouds, and eventually those coalesce and form rain. So the slowing winds just mean a lot less of that is being processed. And there are other sort of micrometeorology, how the droplets form and things like that also change as the winds change.
And what this means in terms of precipitation that we depend upon is that we're experiencing not only earlier snow melt, but also actually less snow to melt.
Right. Yeah. So that we're really seeing both processes in the warmer regions of the Northwest. We're certainly seeing a lot of effect of increasing temperatures in terms of how much snow accumulates and how fast it melts. But as we move towards the colder parts, the fact that we're just plain getting less precipitation means that we get less snow and means that it appears to melt earlier because there's just less to melt.
And you have no doubt that, at least in part, our warming climate is the reason for this slowdown in the winds.
Yes, in part. And we're certainly getting some advanced preview, as it were, from the variations caused by climate cycles.
And, of course, the impact of this for our region is dramatic. And we mentioned lower stream flows. It also means with less precipitation, we're going to have a longer fire season. And we're certainly seeing that all play out.
Right. And the effects that we've seen historically with the decline in precipitation that we've seen since the 50s may be a bit different than what we can expect in the future. Warming temperatures also, the air can hold more moisture. And if you look at the climate models for the future, the fact that the air can hold more moisture has generally been suggesting that the Northwest is getting more precipitation. And now we have this new factor that the winds are slowing down tying into that, and the more research really is needed on how those two interact.
To know whether this is going to be a long-term trend.
Right. To know how far down it might go or how far up. Certainly there have been projections suggesting more rain, but maybe the adding knowledge of this process will dampen those outlooks. Or not dampen, but dry in a sense.
And in terms of what the study means for how we should react to this information, you suggest a couple of actions that maybe should be taken in light of this. For example, thinking about storing more water behind dams for a longer period of time.
Well, the question of storage has already been brought up. When we thought that the only impact of climate change on Northwest was an earlier melting of the snowpack, that there would be the same amount of water. But if the earlier melting is really tied to there being less water, having additional downstream storage in reservoirs wouldn't help us that much. So that's a very important aspect of looking at this distinction in how we get to earlier. Because if it really is just melting snow earlier and there's no change in precipitation, then additional storage may help. If not, then we'd really be needing to look at things like water conservation activities.
You also have stated that certainly more data is needed, that this is very preliminary in terms of what the actual effect is going to be and what the long-term outlook is.
Yes. I think one of the interesting things is how long this particular aspect of our climate since the 1950s has eluded us, and yet the changes are quite large. If you're looking at that sort of dry year pattern, some of the changes have been on the order of a 50% decline. Big number in my book, anyway. The fact that we don't have that much good meteorological information in the mountains is important. And there have certainly been systems added, the Snowtell system in particular, that are helping us now. And continued support for those is important.
And those are the systems that measure snowpack.
Right. So you hear every year now, or many months through the winter, we've received the snowpack is at X percent, and some of that's tied to what's observed at Snowtell stations and some from the snow courses.
Many scientists I speak with, Mr. Luce, who are doing the kind of studies you are about the impacts of climate change, have a sense of urgency about that. Do you share that sense of urgency that we need to get this information as quickly as we can because we need to be adapting as quickly as we can? But some of this information doesn't lend itself to being gathered quickly, does it?
No, I think what's important to realize is that we're going to be learning as we go along. Setting the base now towards getting more information and realizing that information is the important thing that will help us adapt is a key piece of the strategy. And being flexible and adaptive to changes in information as they come out.
Well, it's important work, and I have been speaking with research hydrologist Charlie Luce. Mr. Luce is with the Rocky Mountain Research Station Aquatic Sciences Laboratory in Boise, Idaho, and is the co-author of a new article called Missing Mountain Water, a paper published recently in the journal Science. Mr. Luce, thanks so much for talking with us about this study. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for West Glacier Region, the Potomac Sealy Lake Region, and there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 11 a.m. tomorrow for the Kootenai Cabinet Region, the Flathead Mission Valleys, the Lower Clark Fork Region, the Missoula Bitterroot Valleys, and the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains. Tonight, snow is likely with lows 2 to 9 degrees, and tomorrow snow is also likely with highs 19 to 26 degrees. For central Montana, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front and Eastern Glacier. Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow in the evening and lows 5 to 10 degrees with west winds with potential gusts of up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with snow likely and highs 15 to 20 degrees. Southwest Montana, there is a wind chill advisory in effect until 11 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 6,000 feet for Beaverhead, Madison, and Gallatin counties. Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the night with lows 5 below to 10 below above zero. Tomorrow should be cloudy with snow likely and highs 15 to 25 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Julia Altimus.
I must confess, I am one of the roughly 30 million people in the United States that bought a Christmas tree from the tree farm lot this year. I do have fond memories, however, of many a cold winter's day in December as a youngster, trampling through a deathly quiet forest with only the sounds of an occasional thud as huge clumps of snow would fall from pine tree branches and my own heavy breathing from struggling to extract myself from waist-deep snow in search of the perfect Christmas tree. I was all too eager to pass my wonderful childhood memories along to my own family as we carried on the tradition of chaining up the car, bundling up to look like a Michelin family, and with bungee cords in hand and a toboggan strapped to the top of the car, set off in search of the perfect Christmas tree. The reward when we got back was a steaming cup of hot chocolate with marshmallows and a stick of peppermint, Christmas carols and the scent of a fresh pine tree filling the house. Fast forward to today. I am at an age that the thought of frostbitten toes and fingers overrides the allure of the adventure. So as I longingly and quite guiltily gaze at all the artificial Christmas tree options, I heard my youngest daughter's admonition, "No way are we ever getting a fake tree." Even though my children are adults now, their memories are still vivid. It is first and foremost about the smell of the pine tree that permeates the entire house, and then all that goes with the holiday season. I know there is debate about whether a living tree should be cut as part of a holiday tradition, or whether choosing an artificial tree contributes to global warming, or whether one should support a tree farmer instead of the above. But really, it comes down to personal choice and circumstance. The memories we create and the mark we leave are way more important. However, not everyone has fond memories of Christmases gone by. Just being alone can make the holiday unbearable. Circumstances may find people, our neighbors, in need of food, clothing, and shelter, leading to the Christmas season being quite difficult for some. This is probably why 1/3 of all charitable donations are made the last 3 months of the year, with 18% of the annual total donated in December. In 2012, charitable donations increased by 3.5% for a sum of $316 billion. Volunteers contribute over 15 billion hours every year. Charitable giving and volunteering, our actions, directly impacts communities. Having been raised by a single mother, we didn't have excess of anything, but we had a home, food, boxes of welcome hand-me-down clothes, and toys under the tree on Christmas morning. Growing up, I didn't realize our social circumstance because what we had we shared year-round, especially at Christmas. My mother always made sure we invited what she referred to as shut-ins to our home for dinner. We entertain dinner guests for Christmas every year. I guess the reason I'm sharing the story is because it's not unlike many others from the past or today. Even though growing up we did not have abundance of things, we did have an abundance of goodwill. And isn't goodwill really what Christmas is about? Giving to our community or helping a neighbor has long been an important part of Montana's culture. Whether you choose to be counted as part of the $316 billion in charitable donations, volunteer your time, provide toys or food for families in need, a Christmas tree, artificial or real, or Christmas dinner for a shut-in, our actions serve to help create lasting memories for our own family and others. On behalf of all the families of the Montana Wood Products Association, we wish you cherished memories, a very Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year. I am Julia Altimus. Thanks for listening.
Julia Altimus is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News. And please remember to drive safely.